The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Presentations and interviews with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Kevin LaCroix of Oak Bridge Insurance Services in Ohio, with a review of securities class action trends and D&O issues in 2010. The opinions expressed by guests interviewed on LexisNexis Legal Podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of Reed Elsevier Incorporated, LexisNexis, subsidiary companies, shareholders, employees, or customers, and should not be considered legal advice. Kevin LaCroix is an attorney and a partner in Oak Bridge Insurance Services in Beechwood, Ohio. Oak Bridge is an insurance intermediary focused exclusively on management liability issues. Kevin's been involved in directors and officers' liability insurance issues for more than 25 years. He began his career as a coverage attorney and partner at the Washington, D.C. law firm of Frost, Dixon & Bell. More recently, Kevin served as president of Genesis Professional Liability Managers, a D&O underwriter and part of the Berkshire Hathaway group of companies. Kevin is also the author of the internet weblog, The D&O Diary, at www.dandodiary.com. In addition, Kevin is a columnist for the Insurance Journal. Kevin, it's great to have you with us again on another LexisNexis Legal Podcast.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
2011, well underway. But let's take a look back at 2010 for a little bit. What were some of the important securities class action filing trends that you saw in 2010?
Well, sort of the headline news is that although filings in 2010 were up slightly from 2009, they still remain below historical norms. There were about 177 new securities class action lawsuits in 2010, about 169 in 2009, so slight increase there. But the long-term average is 196, so the filings remain down compared to historical norms. I think to break that up a little bit and see what the numbers are really saying, you have to look at the pace or the timing of the filings during 2010, because the first half of the year filings were significantly down, but they were back up in the second half. The first half there were about 73 filings with 104 in the second half. And I think what was going on there is that diminished number of filings in the first half is a reflection of the fact that the number of new lawsuits related to the subprime meltdown and the financial crisis really dwindled and tapered as the year progressed. And then other things filled in the second half, and that's what led to this sort of upsurge in filings in the second half. And among the things that happened in the second half that led to that surge, I think the most important is there were a number of federal securities class action lawsuits filed related to mergers and acquisitions activity. And that really is a noteworthy development. And in fact, the amount of litigation that was filed related to M&A activity was far disproportionate to the increase in M&A activity itself. So clearly the plaintiff's lawyers, for whatever reason, are becoming more active in filing securities lawsuits related to M&A transactions. And in fact, that has continued even in the first few weeks of 2011 as well. A couple of other things that were happening in the second half that led to that second half increase. One is there was a significant number of new lawsuits filed against Chinese domiciled companies, many of them having recently completed listings on U.S. exchanges. That's not all that surprising because there has, in fact, been an uptick in the number of Chinese companies seeking U.S. listings. But on the other hand, it is noteworthy that among the things that happened in the second half of the year is there was just a rash of new lawsuits involving Chinese companies. The one other thing is that there were a number of new lawsuits in the second half of the year involving for-profit education companies as a result of investigative developments involving those companies and their student lending practices. So those things and some other developments led to an upsurge of filings in the second half of the year. But even with that, the number of filings this year relative to historic norms was down.
How about on the banking front? You know, there were more banks that closed in 2010 than any year since the early 1990s. Has the latest round of bank failures led to more litigation? How do you see that developing in the coming year?
Well, you're right. The number of failed banks in 2010 was the highest number since 1992. And since January 1, 2008 through December 31, 2010, there were 322 financial institutions that were closed by the FDIC. Interestingly enough, although there have been a very few lawsuits brought by the FDIC against former directors and officers, that really has not gotten going yet. Up to this point, the litigation activity has been characterized more by private investor litigation, investors who lost the value of their equity investment of the banks when they were closed by the FDIC. The FDIC has indicated on its website that the FDIC board has authorized lawsuits against 119 former directors and officers, and that number has increased gradually over time. In fact, it's up to 119 from 109 just since the end of 2010. But so far, there have just been four lawsuits brought by the FDIC against former directors and officers, two of those just in the last week. And the two in the last week, those were institutions that have been closed about 2 years. And I think what we're seeing is that the FDIC, as its post-mortem when it takes over the bank, is being very deliberate in considering whether or not to bring these lawsuits. And so I think what that means is this process will be unfolding over quite a number of months and perhaps into several years. But I do expect that as 2011 progresses, we will see more of these FDIC lawsuits against former officers of failed banks. And I think we'll see even more into 2012. And actually, I think that will probably be one of the important litigation development trends over 2011 and 2012 is the increasing number of FDIC lawsuits against former directors and officers of failed banks.
Anything in particular that you base that on?
I like to think that we can count on certain consistency in governmental practices, and just looking at the way the FDIC proceeded during the S&L crisis in the late 80s and early 90s, it was an important part of the tools that the FDIC used to try and recoup losses to the insurance fund by bringing lawsuits against former directors and officers of failed banks. About 24% of the banks that failed during the S&L crisis were the subject of FDIC lawsuits. And if that's the case this time around, that translates into roughly 80 or so lawsuits, and only four have been filed. Now, you know, it may not be exactly 24%, but I still think there's going to be a lot more than the four that have been filed, just given the number of banks that have failed. So I do think we will be seeing more lawsuits. You know, time will tell, of course. I mean, my crystal ball is no better than anybody else's, but I really do think that's one thing we can count on.
A lot of talk in 2010 about Dodd-Frank, the Financial Reform Act. How do you see that affecting D&O claims activity?
To date, really not at all, and there's a pretty specific reason for that. One of the important procedural structures of the Dodd-Frank is that it required rulemaking to implement a number of its statutory reforms, and that's particularly true in a lot of the areas that are likeliest to affect litigation exposures for directors and officers of publicly traded companies. And by way of illustration, I think one area where everybody is expecting there to be some potential impact on D&O exposure is from the whistleblower provisions, and in particular the bounty provision as part of the whistleblower provisions. You know, it provides a financial incentive for whistleblowers to come forward. Well, the SEC is still working on the regulations that will implement that. And so, you know, it hasn't kicked in yet, although it clearly will, and I think it clearly will lead to whistleblowers coming forward, which not only potentially means the possibility for increased SEC enforcement activity in response to the whistleblowing, but also follow-on civil litigation where, you know, as facts come to light as a result of the whistleblowing, investors who see their investment interests impaired seek to pursue claims against the company officials. We've certainly seen that in whistleblowing in the FDA context, the Food and Drug Administration context, where there's been whistleblowing leading to regulatory fines, and then as a result ensuing corporate securities litigation sort of on a follow-on basis. So I really do think that's a pattern we will see. It will emerge over time. It's not going to happen right away. So, you know, as 2011 progresses and into 2012, I think we'll start to see the impact of these new provisions.
Any key U.S. Supreme Court cases from 2010 that had an effect on directors and officers' liability issues?
Yeah, the U.S. Supreme Court in recent court terms, for whatever reason, has shown a heightened interest in taking securities cases. The court has really averaged a couple of cases every term over the last several years, and it's really starting to have an impact. The past term, the most significant case was the Morrison versus National Australia Bank. And the issue there was, when can foreign investors who bought their shares in foreign domiciled companies on foreign exchanges bring suit in the U.S. court under the U.S. securities laws? And to oversimplify a rather complex formula, basically the U.S. Supreme Court in the Morrison case said that in order for a claimant to have access to the U.S. courts under the U.S. securities laws, the transaction has to have taken place in the United States. And that has a significant impact on what had become an important part of U.S. Securities lawsuit filing, which is cases involving foreign domicile companies. And the district courts have really taken Morrison and applied it in an aggressive way. And I think the plaintiff's lawyers have been, I think, disappointed and perhaps even stunned by how actively the district courts are applying it to dismiss cases involving foreign domicile companies. You know, it may be one of those things that be careful what you wish for, because it may encourage claimants to file claims in state court. It may encourage them to file individual rather than class actions. It may encourage them to pursue claims outside the United States and perhaps even to seek alteration of the laws in other jurisdictions so that those investors can pursue claims in their home countries. I don't think we've heard the last. I think there will be reverberations. But, you know, from my conversations with plaintiff's lawyers, they really think that Morrison has and will have a huge impact on securities litigation involving foreign domicile companies. The one other case from the past term was Merck, which was a statute of limitations case, which may sound like a technical procedural issue, but it will have an impact, at least at the margins, on late filed cases or cases that have allegations that reach further back in time. An important case, I think, for litigators, harder for litigants to really appreciate the significance, but nonetheless an important case. I think it will have an impact over time.
Are there any that you're watching in the court's current term?
Yeah, there are three important cases that are going to affect securities law issues. One is the Halliburton case, which is really a class certification case. And again, that may sound like a technical issue, but you can certainly see that if a case is or is not permitted to proceed as a class action, or if the class definition is affected, that clearly affects the scope of the case. The case I'm most interested in is actually one involving Matrix Industries. And there the issue is, when a company has customer complaints, how significant do those customer complaints have to be before the company has to disclose the existence of the customer complaints in its public filings? And although it's couched in a very narrow term in terms of statistical significance, when are the number of complaints statistically significant, The stage is set, I think, for, at least for the possibility that the court will dig deeper and get down to the ultimate meaning of materiality, because only material misrepresentations give rise to liability under the securities laws. And I think that there's at least the possibility that the Supreme Court could issue an opinion that really affects not just this narrow issue of statistical significance, but this broader concept of materiality. And if the court does get into that, it could have a potentially significant impact on future securities litigation. And the Morrison case from last term certainly showed the Supreme Court is not hesitant to make significant changes or pronouncements that could significantly impact securities litigation. So that is one to watch. There's a third case, the Janus case. Although it's in the context of mutual funds, it gets into the issue of who a primary violator is if there are multiple corporate units participating in the disclosure process, who can be the primary violator. The possibility is it could be a very narrow case because it addresses only the mutual fund context, but because it's getting into these core concept of who a primary violator is, there again is the potential for the Supreme Court to issue a broader opinion that has a broader impact. So there are a number of high-profile cases worth watching, and the Supreme Court, for whatever reason, really has shown a heightened interest in recent years compared to the past in taking on these kind of cases. It's really having an impact on securities litigation on a daily basis in the trial court. So it's a significant development.
That's interesting. Well, let's talk about what's happening in the trial courts a little bit. You've talked about securities class action litigation. Are there some other important trends that you're seeing bubble up through the trial courts? And are there areas of emerging liability that you think are worth keeping an eye on?
It's a good question, because although we've been talking mostly about class action securities litigation, what's really been happening on the ground level in the trial courts in terms of the lawsuits that are being filed is that there's a changing mix in the cases that are being filed. And for whatever reason, the mix of cases is shifting away from securities class action lawsuits as a percentage of all filings and more toward other types of corporate and securities litigation. In the past, and as recently as, say, 2006, more than a third of all corporate and securities lawsuits would rather be securities class action lawsuits. But in recent years, and particularly in 2010, that mix has shifted so that in 2010, securities class action lawsuits as a percentage of all corporate and securities lawsuits was below 15%. And what's happened is other types of litigation has filled in. In particular, there's been a growth in the M&A litigation that I alluded to before, which may or may not be in the form of a securities class action lawsuit, but also general breach of fiduciary duty type lawsuit, individual securities lawsuits not brought as class actions. And I think that has important implications for the litigation exposures of corporate officials, because they're under different legal regimes, there are different liability standards, different procedural implications and about how long these cases will unfold and how they will settle and what they will settle for. And all of those are important in terms of the liability scope of corporate officials. Now, you also asked, are there emerging trends and areas that I'm sort of concerned about as we head forward. And there, the number one issue for me is the growing exposure in terms of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act has been around since the late 70s, but it's a tool that regulators and enforcers have been using much more actively in recent years, to the point where the number of enforcement actions brought under the FCPA was higher in 2010 than any other year. And that's not only significant in terms of the enforcement activity, but what we have seen is that there are an increasing number of follow-on civil litigations where claimants bring either derivative suits or breach of fiduciary duty suits against corporate officials, alleging breach of their duty of care and failing to prevent the improper activity from taking place, or requiring the company to have to pay significant regulatory fines. And there has even been securities class action litigation brought against corporate officials in cases involving growing out of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act enforcement actions. And there's a statutory development in the UK, the Bribery Act, which was received royal approval during 2010, but doesn't become active until April 2011. It's a broader statute even than the FCPA in certain significant respects. So I think it just represents another way that sort of bribery-related activity and anti-bribery-related enforcement actions could lead to exposures for corporate officials, and in turn could lead to an increase in related civil litigation. So that's probably my number one choice for emerging areas of corporate and securities litigation exposure.
Well, why do you think there's such an increase in those issues right now? Is it because we do so much more business on an international level?
It's a lot of trends coming together, and certainly the increasing globalization of trade is one factor. The increasing amount of global trade activities in countries whose cultural standards may differ from Western countries. I think there's an increased cooperation between many countries. The enforcement actions brought against Siemens, which resulted in very significant fines, I think in the aggregate it was over $1.5 billion U.S. dollars. That was a result of collaborative activity between a number of governments, which is really a new development. And I think, a number of countries have joined the OECD Convention on Anti-Bribery Commitment, and as more countries are honoring their commitment under that convention, it's leading to increased scrutiny and increased enforcement. I also hope that there's an increasing awareness of the harm that corrupt activities does, both in the countries such as the UK and the US that have these standards, but also in the countries, you know, Nigeria, Indonesia, China, the harm that it does in those countries when this, you know, bribery activity takes place. And I think there's a growing commitment to try and stamp out that kind of activity. You know, I think a lot of forces are coming together. It probably could be the subject of an entire different podcast and why that's so. But the bottom line is there's no doubt that the result is that there's steadily each year over the last several years, there's been more and more enforcement activity in the U.S. and elsewhere. And consistent with that increase in enforcement activity, there's been an increase in civil litigation. And I just think those lines are continued to go upward to the right in 2011, 2012. And I think it represents one of those areas that, you know, advisors to companies are well informed to try and make sure that their clients are keeping an eye on those areas of exposure.
A separate aspect of all this, but one which you are also heavily involved in, is the insurance coverage area. Have there been any important D&O coverage decisions over the past year that have been influential?
Well, you know, if there were a steady thread between all of what we've been talking about so far, I think you'd see that there's a lot of an increased amount of enforcement activity. So the problem is for many companies, they may find themselves facing multiple proceedings simultaneously, investigations, shareholder lawsuits, derivative lawsuits. And so they have different expense centers that are occurring simultaneously. And in many instances, they're looking to their D&O policy to reimburse them for all of these streams. And sometimes the most expensive may be the regulatory or criminal enforcement activity that's going on. And it's a source of great frustration, I think, for many policyholders when they find out that there may be large percentages of their attorney's fees incurred in regulatory and enforcement investigations that are not covered by their D&O policy. And there's been significant litigation developments as companies have wrestled with the question of, you know, what expenses are and are not covered. And the most significant development during 2010 was a case involving Office Depot. The company had both a SEC investigation and a securities class action lawsuit going on simultaneously, and its policy also had a significant retention or deductible. The amount of fees that incurred directly in the securities class action lawsuit was below that very large deductible. The company wanted to get the fees that incurred in connection with the SEC investigation also covered by the D&O insurance. And although it was a technical decision that had to do with the definition of claim under the policy and when an investigation became a claim under the policy, the concern for Office Depot and for all corporate policyholders is the court held that significant amounts of the fees the company incurred before the SEC investigation became a formal investigation were not covered by its policy. So what the marketplace is grappling with now is, you know, when should an investigation become a claim and therefore be covered under the policy? Obviously, policyholders want that point pushed as far back in the process as they can, so as much of their costs are covered under the policy. And the carriers, you know, no surprise, are pushing back and trying to push that point as late in the process as they can. And I think it's one of those things that the industry is grappling with. I would say this is probably the most contentious issue right now, is how much of the SEC-related investigative defense costs are covered under the D&O policy. And I think it's one that the marketplace is just going to continue to wrestle with. There is no equilibrium solution that the marketplace has come up with, and it's one that I think that we're just going to have to wait and see how it evolves.
Do you think then that that's the most important thing for corporate board members to understand about their D&O insurance?
That's an important issue, and I certainly think it's one that they want to make sure that they fully aired out with their insurance advisor and their outside counsel. But for, you know, corporate boards, if, you know, I don't always have the luxury of being able to speak directly to boards, but when I do, the one thing I want to make sure they understand is that if they get into one of these scenarios where it's a catastrophic claim situation, where there are multiple proceedings going on simultaneously, that the insurance that insures them as board members is shared with the inside officers of the company and with the entity itself. And what that means is the proceeds of the policy can be eroded very quickly. And the ultimate danger is they could be left in sort of a nuclear winter scenario with no remaining D&O insurance, but not all of the proceedings yet resolved. Now, there are a couple of implications there. One is you just need to look carefully at the amount of D&O insurance that you're buying. And I think that as defense fees have escalated, traditional concepts of what constitutes adequate limits really has changed. And that's definitely an issue that the board would want to discuss with their outside counsel and with their insurance advisor. But another issue, particularly for independent directors, outside directors who are not officers of the company, they may want to look at the structure of their program and examine the question whether it makes sense for the company to buy, as part of its overall D&O package, a separate part or component of their structure that includes D&O insurance that for which the only named insurers are the independent directors themselves, so that no matter what happens, no matter what unfolds, that there's a pot of money with their names on it that can't be eroded by the fees or exposures of any other officer or even the entity itself, so that they don't find themselves in one of those catastrophic situations without D&O insurance remaining to provide for their defense expense. That usually gets the attention of most boards that I talk to. Regrettably, the insurance decisions are usually made by the CFO or general counsel, and these issues are not necessarily as important to them as to corporate boards. And I often try to suggest when I do speak to boards that they may want to have an independent advisor review their insurance program just to make sure that these kinds of issues are being looked at appropriately and that their interests, which can diverge from that of the inside officers, that their interests are being looked at carefully so that all of these questions are being addressed appropriately.
Sounds like a very good suggestion. Well, to wrap up, Kevin, what do all these developments mean for the D&O insurance marketplace? Where do you see it all headed in the coming year?
You know, the interesting thing, you know, when I speak to people who are not participants in the D&O insurance marketplace, their assumption, given all of the kinds of things we've just been talking about, is that, gee, I would think that the price for D&O insurance is going up and it's becoming more difficult to get, desirable terms and conditions. The interesting thing is exactly the opposite is going on, with a couple of exceptions. Basically, it's just a question of supply and demand. The availability of insurance is really just a reflection of the availability of supply. And because there really haven't been significant insurance events in the global insurance marketplace, there haven't been hurricanes, there haven't been earthquakes, there have not been significant terrorist events that dramatically reduce the availability of insurance capital, there's an adequate supply. And so for the buyers, that means that generally they can continue to get attractive terms and conditions at attractive prices. And I think there's even downward pressure on pricing. So it's a buyer's market for most buyers now, notwithstanding everything that we've been talking about. The exception is banks, in particular community banks, and financial institutions generally. Just as a result of the events of the last several years, that area of the marketplace remains under pressure, particularly for community banks, because the insurers know that the litigation environment is changing and that the claims are going to emerge over the next couple of years. But taking those two categories and kind of setting them to the side, for most other buyers, at least those that are in reasonably stable financial condition, they can hope to get broad terms and conditions at an attractive price. So it doesn't necessarily make sense to outside observers, but it's really just the ironclad logic of the laws of supply and demand, and that's driving the whole marketplace.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be interesting to see how the coming year shakes out. Kevin, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your review and analysis of some of the top events of the past year and what you see coming up. It's always great to have you part of these LexisNexis legal podcasts.
My pleasure, Steve. I enjoyed the chance to speak with you today.
Thank you for listening to this LexisNexis legal podcast. Visit the LexisNexis communities at www.lexisnexis.com/community. The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Copyright 2011 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated. I'm Steve Bursler. Thank you for listening.